Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. We are currently studying the book of Genesis, so open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
We are in Genesis 39 tonight. Genesis 38 took us over into the story of Judah and Tamar. And when we last saw Joseph, am I alone up here? Last time we saw Joseph, his brothers had sold him to a traveling band of Ishmaelites because they wanted to be rid of him. And then they ended up taking his multicolored coat back to Dad and saying, "What do you make of this? Is this your son's coat?" And he said, "Yes," and it was blood covered. They had put animal blood on it. And poor Jacob believed that his favorite son was dead. And then at that moment, Moses took us on this little side road and told us the story of Judah and Tamar so that we could understand the lineage and history of the seed that was going to lead to Christ. And then in chapter 39, he starts with the word, "Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt." So it's like Moses going, "Oh, yeah, that's right. I left Joseph over here, and he had been sold, and he'd been traveling with Ishmaelites. Now let's go back to his story."
So now does that mean that during this time is when Judah and Tamar happened? Like while he was in slavery?
Yes, it does mean that the Judah-Tamar story happened while he was in slavery. Because chapter 38 starts with, "And it was about at that time that Judah departed from his brothers." So right about the time that they convinced Dad that Joseph was dead was right on the time that Judah left and he went and took wives, and then that whole story happens about him having sons and then him going to his daughter-in-law and all that happens, and then Moses backtracks dramatically to go, "Okay, now let me pick up that other story I had going." So starting at chapter 39, "Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an Egyptian officer of the Pharaoh, the captain of the bodyguard, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there." So now we're back to talking about Joseph. The key element, I believe, of the whole Joseph story is, as I said last week, the fact that despite Joseph's ups and downs, despite the fact that Joseph is going to go through triumphs, as he's going to here at Potiphar's house, and then he's going to go through being accused of a crime he doesn't commit. He's going to be accused of rape by Potiphar's wife, and he's going to end up in prison. And yet while he's in prison, he's going to be reassured one more time that God is with him nevertheless. So you're going to see him really thrive in Potiphar's house, and it's going to say, because the Lord was with him. And then he's going to end up in prison, but he's going to do okay in prison because the Lord is with him. And the theme here is, regardless of the triumphs or regardless of being downcast, that didn't change the relationship with God. God was with him anyway. God was guiding him through it anyway. And it's only when you know the end of the story, which we fortunately do, that Joseph is now going to end up second only to Pharaoh, and as a result bring all his brothers into Egypt, set them up as kings, keep them all alive. Now we realize that even this very strange moment where Joseph is going to retain his integrity, he's not going to give in to Potiphar's wife. She's going to unjustly accuse him, and then her husband's going to be forced to put him in prison in order to protect his wife's reputation. And so Joseph, sitting in prison at that moment, could very easily have said, "Well, none of this is fair. I mean, I worked hard, and I had control and command of this guy's whole house. I was nothing but fair to this guy, and now here I am sitting in prison." But the end of it is, while he's in prison, he's going to meet the baker and the cupbearer that directly report to Pharaoh, and he's going to interpret their dreams. Pharaoh's going to end up having a dream that he can't interpret, which is going to bring Joseph into the court of Pharaoh, and eventually then Joseph is going to become second only to Pharaoh and then keep all his Israelite brethren alive. So the end of the story shows you that even as God was putting him in prison, he was actually taking him to the next step of where he was going to use him. So when we go through those really bad times, when you go through those moments of, gee, everything was going really good, and then suddenly everything goes really bad, and you come crashing down, and you end up in prison, it just looks like your whole life fell apart, it may very well be that that is God using means to transfer you to the next thing he has planned for you in life. God's plan was just as effective during the prison time as it was during the Potiphar time or the Pharaoh time. God was still at work. And that's what we're really going to see tonight. And Moses is going to emphasize it tonight, that it was all part of God's ultimate plan. And even though Joseph couldn't have seen that as he was going through it, and even though I'm sure it felt tremendously unfair at the time, nevertheless, God was intimately involved in the details of everything he went through. Got all that? Rick, you had your hand up.
Yes, sir. Going back to the time just before this story, it looks like one of the notes in this New Geneva Study Bible suggests that because of the intermarrying that was going on with the Canaanites and the risk of this seed family losing their identity, that God met this threat by sending Joseph ahead of them into Egypt, where they were to be segregated. So again, it's part of giving meaning to what Joseph later says, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, this is God setting up the path to take them all to the place where the food will be, set them up as shepherd kings. But it's even bigger than that. I would stretch the thinking beyond just their preservation to the fact that God had told Abraham, when Abraham said, how do I know that I'll possess this land? The answer that Abraham received included, well, your descendants are going to go into a land where they're not known. They're going to serve them there for 400 years. I'll bring them out with a mighty hand. I'll bring them back to this very land.
Exactly.
All of that has to happen. And so even Joseph being sent ahead, the Potiphar situation, the prison situation tonight, bless you, my goodness, all of that is not only serving to keep them alive, it's ultimately serving for God to keep his own word. God's word of promise was, I'm going to do all this to prove it to you, so that theoretically, when I bring them back to this land, they will go, well, this must be our land. Everything God said he was going to do, he did.
Right.
So yeah, there's a whole lot of stuff going on here with Joseph that is absolutely God's providence, God doing exactly what he predicted he would do, and yet I doubt that Joseph at the moment could have seen it when he lands in prison tonight.
And,
and so we have to remember that God's hand is at work in the good times and the bad times. All right, chapter 39. So Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an Egyptian officer of Pharaoh, the captain of his bodyguard, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. And the Lord was with Joseph, so he became a successful man. And he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. Isn't that interesting language? The Lord was with Joseph so that he became a successful man. If you stop right there, you can go, well, there it is, the prosperity doctrine. If God is with you, you're going to become a successful man. Says so right there. Now, he's going to be unjustly accused, and he's going to end up in prison. And while he's in prison, it's going to say, and the Lord was with him. Both of those are true. You can't just extricate this idea from the rest of the text and say, the Lord was with Joseph, and therefore he was successful in everything he touched. The Lord was also with him in putting him in prison, because that was the method by which he was going to get his brothers there, everything Rick and I just talked about. Now his master saw that the Lord was with him, and how the Lord caused all that he did to prosper in his hand. Isn't that interesting? That Joseph was so successful that Potiphar, an Egyptian, who bought this Hebrew boy as a slave, nevertheless recognized that everything the boy did prospered, and he credits it to the fact that this Hebrew God must be blessing this boy. And he's a smart enough man to go, I should take advantage of this. Everything this guy touches works. I'll put him in charge of everything. So Joseph, verse 4, so Joseph found favor in his sight. That's a really interesting phrase. Because even in the New Testament, we read that as Jesus grew, that he found favor with God and man. Paul talks about this idea that we will find favor among human beings because God will make certain relationships in your life work in such a way that you cannot explain why you're getting all this good favor. And it's because God has some purpose to it. in just a few verses here, we're going to find out that he falls out of favor with Potiphar and is going to be put in prison by Potiphar. Did his relationship with God change as a result of any of that? Nope, this is all God's plan. But it's God who produced the favor, and it's God that produced the downfall in order to produce the end result, which is many people kept alive. All God. That's all I'm saying. All God. Everybody got that? All God. We can go now then. We're done. Because all God is all I'm trying to get to tonight. So Joseph found favor in his master's sight, and he became his personal servant. And he made him overseer over his house, and all that he owned was put in his charge. And it came about that from the time that he made him overseer in his house and over all that he owned, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house on account of Joseph. Thus the Lord's blessing was upon all that the Egyptian owned in the house and in the field, so that he left everything he owned in Joseph's charge, and with him there was not any concern of his own with anything except the food which he ate. In other words, he put every responsibility he had in Joseph's hands, because Joseph was so wildly successful with everything he touched, and the only thing this guy had to worry about every day was, what will I eat? That's all he worried about. He got up every day and went, food. Donuts. That was his whole life. Yes. That was his only concern in life, because Joseph did everything else. Now, I want you to see how ingrained Joseph is in this guy's life. This guy is completely dependent now on Joseph to run every aspect of his business. And apparently it was a pretty large, thriving business. So he left everything he owned in Joseph's charge. And with him, he did not concern himself with anything except the food which he ate. Now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. And it came about that after these events, that his master, Potiphar's wife, looked with desire at Joseph. And she said, come lay with me. But he refused and said to his master's wife, behold with me here. My master does not concern himself with anything in the house, and he has put all that he owns in my charge. And there is no one greater in this house than me, and he has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do this great evil and sin against God? I have to pause there for a moment and see if I can rewind your brains to this past Sunday. Because on Sunday we had a conversation about sin and who you sin against. And even though you may trespass against other people, all sin is ultimately against God. And that's how Joseph framed it here. She said, come sin with me. He said, how can I sin against God? Because you can only sin against the righteous Holy One. All sin is ultimately sin against God. I may have a disagreement with Tom. Tom and I might get ugly with each other, and one of us may end up doing something sinful to the other. I'm not counting on that, but that might happen. But ultimately, whatever damage Tom may do to me, whatever trespass, if Tom does something against me, in the end, so what? Who am I? Really, who am I that I can get so haughty about it that I can go, well, Tom sinned against me? Who am I? I'm a sinner too. I'm nothing more than a worm. I'm just going to use Bible language. So what am I, the chief maggot? I'm the best of all the maggots on the maggot pile. Therefore, if you sin against me, you've really upset me. I'm just another sinner. But there is a standard. There is a righteousness. There is a holiness that resides in God. And therefore, whenever any creature in his universe acts contrary to God's holiness, it is ultimately a sin against God. That is why the payment that Christ made was payment to God. Christ did not have to pay a debt to me because Tom sinned against me. I'm not owed anything. But Christ took the punishment from God that was owed God because all sin is against God. Understand that? And so he said, how could I do this great evil and sin against God? And it came about, as she spoke to Joseph day after day, that he did not listen to her to lie beside her or be with her. So apparently this is an ongoing thing. She's chasing this boy down. And he continues to retain his integrity. He says, no, he won't do it. Now it happened one day that he went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the household were there inside. And she caught him by his garment, saying, lie with me. Now the garment there, we're probably talking about, think Egyptian culture, think hot desert culture. We're talking about sort of a wraparound tunic thing that might have had a belt, you know, around the waist or something. Not a complicated piece of machinery here. So he has some cloth wrapped around him, and she grabs a hold of his garment, saying, lay with me. And he apparently pulled away from her in such a way that he left his garment in her hand, and he fled and he went outside. So he still did nothing wrong, except that he's running out of the house with no clothes on. Not a good look when there are no other men in the house. When she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and had fled outside, she called to the men of her household, and she starts conspiring her little scheme. I've got his clothes in my hand. He just ran out of the house. He won't lay with me. I'll make him pay. When she saw that he had left the garment in her hand and had fled outside, she called the men of her household, and she said to them, see, he, as in my husband, has brought in a Hebrew to us to make sport of us. He came in to me to lay with me, and I screamed. And it came about, when he heard that I raised my voice and screamed, that he left his garment beside me, and he fled, and he went outside. So she left his garment beside her until his master came home. Potiphar comes home in verse 17, and she spoke to him with these words, saying, the Hebrew slave who you brought to us came in to me to make sport of me, and it happened as I raised my voice and screamed that he left his garment beside me and fled outside. All of the evidence points against Joseph. There's no good evidence here. She's saying, do something about this. This boy tried to rape me. He's a Hebrew. We don't like Hebrews anyway. This is your fault. You brought him into the house. Now, despite all the good he's done to his master, Potiphar is now forced to judge against Joseph. Now it came to pass, when Potiphar heard the words of his wife, which she spoke to him, saying, this is what your slave did to me, that his anger burned. So Joseph's master took him and put him in jail, the place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in the jail. Very interesting little detail Moses adds, that he put him in jail, but because he's a powerful man, he put him in the particular jail where the king's prisoners are kept. This is not the common jail. This is the king's prisoner jail. As a result, he's going to bump into two men who work directly with Pharaoh. So God is orchestrating all of this, is my point. God knows that if Joseph stays at Potiphar's house, he's never going to gain the kind of power necessary to bring his brothers into Egypt, set them up as kings, feed them, make them wealthy, set them up in the land of Goshen, and let them rule over the Egyptians. He's not going to have that kind of authority from Potiphar. He's got to get to Pharaoh's house. We, fleshly humans, like to think that the most natural way for God to do that would be for Pharaoh to come to Potiphar's house one day and say, my goodness, what a good slave you have. I'd like to take him and put him to work in my house. And then God blesses him, and then he becomes second only to Pharaoh, and it's all a really rosy-cheeked story. And we all just go, that's wonderful, good old God. But the way God did it, the way God chose to do it instead was to have him accused unjustly of rape and thrown into prison. We know the end of the story. Really good things are coming from this. Nevertheless, God actively put him in prison for his own purposes.
Well, so if he'd done it that way, we would have been able to say, Joseph, he's such a good guy. It's a good thing he was working hard so that Pharaoh could see.
Prosperity doctrine would have kicked in.
Yeah, yep. That's right.
But you know, we also like to think that God would never allow one of his children to be unjustly accused.
I know. God, he let Jesus be unjustly accused.
Exactly right.
Why would that bother us? I mean,
I'm talking about the way flesh works, the fleshly mind, our fleshly concepts of God, what God's like, who God is. We would naturally think, well, God wants nothing but the best for his children.
Right.
And he would never let one of his children be unjustly accused.
Right.
But you're absolutely right. He let his son be unjustly accused. There was a story several years ago, probably half the room has already heard this, But John Riesinger, back when he was traveling and preaching, after the end of the Vietnam War, John had lost one of his sons in the Vietnam War. And there was a woman who walked up to him and said, "Pastor Riesinger, I have a question for you. Where was your God when your son was killed?" And John said, "Same place he was when his son was killed, sitting on his throne doing whatever pleased him." That's the right answer. So once you get a hold of that, then when you go through the trials in life, and you're going to, life is going to have its ups and downs and its trials, and the natural assumption, our fleshly natural assumption when things go bad, is to start asking questions like, "Why me? Why God? Why this? Don't you love me anymore? What did I do to deserve this? Did our relationship change?" And the reality that we see here in the Joseph story is nothing changed in the relationship. Same God, same Joseph, same plan, same work, and yet Joseph is going through unbelievably difficult circumstances. Would you like to go to jail accused of rape when you know you didn't do it? No, no fun there. I'm just trying to get you into the mindset that Joseph had to have been in. I'm sure at this moment when he's being plunged into prison that he is not thinking, "God is working mightily in me." You know, that's not the mindset, I'm sure. He was thinking, "How did this happen? All I did was the right thing. All I did was prosper my master. All I did was refuse her. I've been unjustly accused, and now here I am in prison." Verse 20. "So Joseph's master took him and put him in jail, the place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in the jail. But the Lord was with Joseph and extended kindness to him." Juxtapose these two verses for a moment. His master saw that the Lord was with him and how the Lord caused all that he did to prosper in his hand. That's verse 3. Verse 21, he's in jail, but the Lord was with Joseph and extended kindness to him. The Lord is with him in both those circumstances. The Lord is with him when he's prospering. The Lord is with him when he's in prison. It's all part of what God has intended for Joseph. Are you getting the message yet? Are you getting a sense of this? Because I guarantee you, live long enough, there are going to be big potholes in your life. As you're cruising down the highway of life, if you don't mind the highway analogy, you're going to hit the really rough spots in life. Live long enough, you're going to go through a lot of difficulties in your life. And it's going to be real natural to start questioning your faith and to start questioning, where is God in this? But the Bible is chock full of faithful people. Read Hebrews 11. People who, because of their faith, were sawn in two and driven through with spears and killed, martyred for their faith. Certainly the people who wrote the New Testament, not a one of them ever accomplished health, wealth, and prosperity. They all died martyrs' deaths because of their faith. So faith and trouble are not contradictory to each other. Faith and trouble is part of this world, because Jesus walked around saying things like, "If you were of the world would love its own. But you are not of the world. I've chosen you out of the world. Therefore, the world hates you. But it hated me before it hated you." They hated him without a cause. Why wouldn't they hate you without a cause? This is the feel-good message, isn't it? This is just cheering us right up. But ultimately, it is a feel-good message. Because when you do go through your trial and your struggle, your faith isn't going to waver, because you're going to remember God was with Joseph through the ups and the downs.
And people are going to look at you like, "Are you not upset?" And you're like, "God's sovereign."
Yeah, God's sovereign.
You mean for evil. God means for good.
Yeah, absolutely.
Put it on everybody else. You mean for
evil. Rick, you had your hand up.
Yeah, another study note here has an interesting idea that might be a good insight. It says, though Potiphar's anger may have initially been directed at Joseph, his subsequent action indicates that he doubted his wife's accusation. Attempted rape of the master's wife by a slave would probably have earned a death sentence, yep, but Joseph's punishment, confinement with the king's prisoners, was relatively mild.
Mm-hmm.
For Joseph, that could have added insult to injury. If he thought Potiphar knew he was innocent and yet still put him in prison anyway, but yet it was this special kind of prison or jail,
yeah,
where as you...
Well, he's going to be treated better. In fact, as you're going to see in a minute, he's actually treated quite well in the prison.
There's going to be an opportunity there that God's going to put before him that wouldn't be there otherwise.
Absolutely. But I think Potiphar realized that in the long term, it was he had to choose, do I want to live with Joseph or live with my wife? And he realized he had to make it... Yeah. He made the wise choice, says the married woman. But the Lord was with Joseph and extended kindness to him and gave him favor in the sight of the chief jailer. Here we see it again. It was God who created the favor. Just like God created favor with Potiphar, now God creates favor with the jailer. Now, if you can get a hold of that for a minute, this might be tough, but dig around in your brain for a minute. And ask yourself, really, what is there about you that is of such high quality that people really ought to like you? I mean, really, what is there about you that is just so positive that if somebody doesn't like you, they're just wrong? How dare they not like you? I mean, you're you, for heaven's sake. Instead, if you really get a sense of how God sees you, with all this concept of our depravity and our general wickedness, and if you're really honest with yourself and take stock of some of the thoughts that run through your head when you think no one else can hear them, and the intentions of your heart that are not always good, then you can start to recognize that if anybody likes you in this life, it has to be a direct result of the fact that God showed favor here.
Or blinded them.
And caused them to want to like you, caused them to want to be around you, showed favor. I've been in so many circumstances in my life where I really can't explain why it went that well. There's just no explanation for it. Something happened, everything fell into line, bang, 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 the deal is closed, everything's good. I can't explain it. Outside of, well, it's grace, it's God's grace. God showed favor. So he showed favor in the sight of the chief jailer, and the chief jailer committed to Joseph's charge all the prisoners that were in the jail, so that whatever was done there, he was responsible for it. The chief jailer did not supervise anything under Joseph's charge because the Lord was with him. And whatever he did, the Lord made him prosper. He prospered in jail. Isn't that a strange juxtaposition? And the form that the prospering took was that the chief jailer recognized this guy is so responsible. This guy was so good with Potiphar, taking care of his whole household. This guy is so trustworthy and responsible, even in jail. You'll notice that Joseph's attitude did not go bad when he got in jail. He didn't go in there and say, well, that's it then. Forget God. Forget my integrity. I did the right thing and wound up in jail, so forget it. I'm not doing good anymore. That's the way we mostly think. I tried it. I tried to be good. It didn't pay off. Why bother? The chief jailer committed to Joseph's charge all the prisoners that were in the jail. He was such a responsible guy, he winds up being the jailer instead of the jailed, even though he's still in prison. So, chapter 40 begins. Then it came about, after these things, that the cupbearer and the baker for the king of Egypt, the Pharaoh, offended their lord, the king of Egypt. On the surface, that would have seemed like a fairly arbitrary thing. Somehow the baker and the cupbearer offended the Pharaoh bad enough that he put them both in prison to teach them a lesson. That seems arbitrary, but you know what that was? That is the key connection between Joseph in prison and Pharaoh on his throne. God is in charge of every one of these minute details. So I keep saying there's no mistakes, there's no accidents. Every little detail of what goes on in life is all God working out his master plan to get his people to their ultimate goal, to their salvation. And the stuff that you think is insignificant, that's the stuff that, if you go back and trace all your steps, how did I ever come to know anything about God? Why do I care about the Bible? You can go back and trace it, and you'll find that it's a whole series of apparently insignificant events. I remember Jeff and Jennifer the first time they came by here. They said they'd been praying that there would be a Sovereign Grace Church somewhere within driving distance. And Jeff happened to be driving down the road the day that we put the banner on the garage after we'd bought this building. And said, Grace Christian Assembly, a Sovereign Grace. And he called me up and found me in the phone book, called me up and said, really? And I said, yeah, really? Yeah. They live around the corner. They live closer than probably anybody here. Here we were right around the corner from them, and that's what they'd been looking for. Now, how did all that come about? There was a whole series of circumstances and events that led them to move from Memphis to come to Smyrna, that brought me here to Smyrna, that brought the family here, that then this house that was built by an army general who then died before he ever made his first payment. He was in a wheelchair so that the building could be used as a public building. It's on a, all these little events that led to Jeff and I standing in the hallway of that building out there one day and him saying, so you're really a premillennial sovereign grace preacher? I said, yes, I am. He said, that's what I believe. I thought I was the only one. I said, now there's two of us. And if you just trace all the little circumstances that got us here, it's a remarkably complex web of apparently arbitrary events. But here we are. God knows what he's doing. Next time I'll tell you the Tom story, which is also full of really interesting little intricate events. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's go back 20 years.
Tom and I pick up 20 years ago. Yeah. Because he played guitar and I played drums. And here we are. And Pharaoh was furious with his two officials, the chief cupbearer and the chief baker. So he put them in confinement in the house of the captain of the bodyguard in the jail in the same place where Joseph was imprisoned. How lucky was that? Huh? Man, God lucked out again. And the captain of the bodyguard put Joseph in charge of them. Of course, he's in charge of all the prisoners. And he took care of them, and they were in confinement for some time. Then the cupbearer and the baker for the king of Egypt, who were confined in jail, both had a dream the same night. Now their dreams are going to become the conduit between Joseph in jail and Pharaoh on his throne. So then who's in charge of this dream? Who's in charge of the fact that this night they're both going to have a dream and they're both going to be perplexed by their dreams? This is all God. It's all God doing all this. And then God's going to give Pharaoh a dream that Pharaoh can't figure out, and it's going to plague him until the cupbearer says, wait a minute, there was this guy in jail who told me my dream, and he told me the baker's dream, and he was right both times. So now here God is working, talk about in the minutiae, in the detail, he's now working in the particular dreams that Egyptian unbelievers are having in order to advance Joseph to the position God wants him in order to save Israel alive. See all the details at work? See, when I say God is sovereign, I'm not just saying, when I say sovereign, I mean election, predestination, all that stuff, doctrine, blah, blah. I'm saying, pick an aspect of life, and I'll show you somewhere in the Bible where God's in charge of it. I don't care what it is, pick something, God's in charge. Because he's God and you're not. Verse 5, then the cupbearer and the baker for the king of Egypt who were confined in jail both had a dream on the same night, each man with his own dream. And each dream with its own interpretation. When Joseph came to them in the morning and observed them, he beheld that they were dejected. And he asked Pharaoh's officials who were with him in confinement in his master's house, why are your faces so sad today? Then they said to him, we have had a dream, and there is no one to interpret it. Then Joseph said to them, do not interpretations belong to God? Tell it to me, please. Isn't that interesting? He says, if this is a dream, then God gave you the dream. And if it's plaguing you, then God knows the interpretation. Joseph did not say, well, I happen to be big-time prophet guy. Let me tell you about some dreams I had. I'll tell you about the whole sheaf thing. Well, I have 11 brothers. And, well, their sheaves all bowed down to mine. That was a good dream. Hasn't come true yet. I'm in prison, but I had that dream. And then there was the one where the sun and the moon and the stars all bowed down to me. And I'm Mr. Dream Guy. In fact, I've just opened the Joseph School of Dream Technology. No, instead, he immediately gave credit to God. He's in prison, and he's saying, it's all God. It's all God. Tell me your dream. Let's see what God has to say. Verse 9. So the chief cupbearer told his dream to Joseph and said to him, in my dream, behold, there was a vine in front of me, and on the vine were three branches, and as it was budding, its blossoms came out, and its clusters produced ripe grapes. Now Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, so I took the grapes and I squeezed them into Pharaoh's cup, and I put the cup in Pharaoh's hand. Then Joseph said to him, this is the interpretation of it. The three branches are 3 days. Within 3 more days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your office. And you will put Pharaoh's cup into his hand according to your former custom when you were his cupbearer. Only keep me in mind when it goes well with you. And please do me a kindness by mentioning me to Pharaoh and get me out of this prison. So he gives him the proper interpretation. He says, in 3 days, you're going back to your old job. Now, that's a real testable interpretation. You'll notice he did not give him something wild and vague. He said, in 3 days, this is what's going to happen. Which means in 4 days, if he's still in prison, Joseph's a fraud. The interpretation is 3 days from now, you're going to go back and be the cupbearer. And when you do, do you know what cupbearer is? Do you know what the job of cupbearer was? Nehemiah was cupbearer for a while. This is a job where you have a great deal of intimacy with the king, even though you're not royalty. You're the guy who takes the cup to Pharaoh and you sip it before you hand it to him. And if you don't drop dead, he'll drink. If you die, then you gave your life for the sake of the king. So the cupbearer is a very trusted guy. Because if anybody is going to be able to poison the king, it's going to be the cupbearer. Because he's going to take that sip and then somehow get the poison in. So it's a real trusted, close relationship. So then, only keep in mind, he said, that when this all goes well with you, please do me a kindness by mentioning me to Pharaoh and get me out of this house. For I was, in fact, kidnapped from the land of the Hebrews, and even here I have done nothing that they should put me into this dungeon. When the chief baker saw that he had interpreted favorably, he said to Joseph, I also saw in my dream, and behold, there were 3 baskets of white bread on my head. And in the top basket, there were some of all sorts of baked food for Pharaoh. And the birds were eating them out of the basket on my head. Then Joseph answered and said, this is the interpretation. The 3 baskets are 3 days. Within 3 more days, Pharaoh will lift up your head from you and will hang you on a tree, and the birds will eat your flesh. There's 2 very testable interpretations. One good, one bad, both from God. Thus, it came about on the 3rd day, which was Pharaoh's birthday, that he made a feast for all his servants, and he lifted up the head of the chief cupbearer and the head of the chief baker among his servants, and he restored the chief cupbearer to his office, and he put the cup into Pharaoh's hand, but he hanged the chief baker just as Joseph had interpreted to them. Yet the chief cupbearer did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. So Joseph continues to languish in the prison, even as the cupbearer goes back to his job, being the sinner that he is. Now, what was God's purpose in putting the cupbearer into prison, then restoring him to his job? And what was the purpose of God putting the baker into prison and then hanging him? Because it's the same purpose.
His glory.
His glory, but what's the big purpose?
To show that Joseph can interpret dreams correctly.
To show that Joseph can interpret dreams correctly. This is all conduit to getting Joseph to be second only to Pharaoh. So, was God willing in order to keep Israel alive? Was he willing to put a baker in prison and then hang him 3 days later?
Yeah.
In order to put Joseph in the position he wanted Joseph in order to keep Israel alive, because those were his chosen people who have the Abrahamic covenant? Is God willing to work that favorably toward one group of people and that negatively toward someone else in order to accomplish his own word and his own promise? Is he willing to do that?
Yes,
he did it. That's how God works. And you can't help but see particularity there. You can't help but see distinction there. And you can't help but see that God is going to keep his word to the people he has promised his word to. And to the rest of the people, they're going to suffer under his hand, whether that's his ultimate wrath or whether that's his rejection. People are going to be judged by God. People are going to be punished by God. And people are going to be saved by God. It's all God. So when we get to the New Testament and you see things like God bestowing favor on this person and not this person, is that any different than the way that we've seen God work all the way through the Bible?
Nope.
It's the same God working the exact same way. It's the way he's always worked, which is why it surprises me when I tell people something Paul has written or something Jesus has said, like in John 6, those passages where you see the great particularity of salvation, where God chooses and picks and elects and shows his kindness to particular people and then punishes other people. And folks go, I don't like that God. Your God's a monster. Your God. I say, it's not my God. That's the God of the Bible. It's the only God you find in the Bible. He's like that. He's always been like that. That's how he works. The only God in the Bible keeps his promises and covenants to those people he chose to have covenant relationship with. What was Abraham doing when God chose him and made his covenant with him?
Making idols.
Making idols! So which part of that caused God to say, oh, you're the good one. Out of the whole planet, I choose you to make my covenant with.
You know, it doesn't say that God did not like the baker, or the baker was a bad man, or the baker did not accept him.
Well, I also assume, by the way, that they both ended up in prison because they'd done something. Right? I mean, you don't normally throw people in prison because you're so offended at them unless they've done something.
Or the king could just have taken offense.
It says the king was offended at them both. But my point is this. The king's offense was against both of them. But did God save both of them?
Right.
Were they both innocent or were they both guilty?
Both guilty.
They were both guilty. So God showed favor to one and the other got the judgment he deserved.
Yeah.
But isn't that exactly the way we always talk about God? There is nobody that deserves God's favor. There is nobody that deserves God's kindness. We're all guilty. And yet God shows favor among some people. You see it here again. The theology is consistent. This isn't something that we have to make up and compose in order to say, no, really, honestly, it's like this. It's all the way through the Bible. The baker had a dream. The cupbearer had a dream. Then the cupbearer forgets about Joseph. So chapter 41 starts, now it happened at the end of 2 full years. Do you think Joseph was discouraged yet?
Yeah.
I accurately told the cupbearer what would happen. He's been restored and he has completely forgotten about me. 2 years, he's still in what he called a dungeon, waiting, hoping that maybe the guy up there, his only hope to get out of prison, would remember him. So God intervenes. After 2 full years, Pharaoh had a dream. And behold, he was standing by the Nile. And lo, from the Nile, the river, there came up 7 cows, sleek and fat, and they grazed on the marsh grass. Then behold, 7 other cows came up from the Nile, ugly and gaunt, and they stood by the other cows on the bank of the Nile, and the ugly, skinny, gaunt cows ate the 7 sleek, fat cows. Then Pharaoh woke up. Yeah. That's enough to get you up. It's enough to make you wonder what you ate before bedtime.
Steak.
I walked right into that. I even had my eyes open and I walked right flat into that. And he fell asleep and he dreamed a second time, and behold, 7 ears of grain came up on a single stalk, plump and good. And behold, 7 ears thin and scorched by the east wind sprouted up after them. And the thin ears swallowed up the 7 plump full ears. Then Pharaoh awoke, and behold, it was a dream. Now it came about in the morning that his spirit was troubled. So he sent and called for all the magicians of Egypt and all the wise men. And Pharaoh told them his dreams, but there was no one who could interpret them for Pharaoh. Then the chief cupbearer spoke to Pharaoh, saying, I would make mention today of my own offenses. Pharaoh was furious with his servants, and he put me in confinement in the house of the captain of the bodyguard, both me and the chief baker, and we had a dream on the same night, he and I. Each of us dreamed according to the interpretation of his own dream. Now a Hebrew youth was with us there, a servant of the captain of the bodyguard, and we related them to him, and he interpreted our dreams for us. To each one he interpreted according to his own dream. And it came about that just as he interpreted for us, so it happened. He restored me in my office, but he hanged him. Then Pharaoh sent and called for Joseph, and they hurriedly brought him from the dungeon. When he had shaved himself and changed his clothes, he came in to Pharaoh, and Pharaoh said to Joseph, I've had a dream, but no one can interpret it. And I have heard it said about you that you can hear a dream and you can interpret it. Joseph then answered Pharaoh and said, it is not me. God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer. Now think about it. This is a Hebrew boy. He's a slave. And he's standing in front of the most powerful man in the Middle East at the time. And he's going to favor Joseph if Joseph can come up with a good interpretation. This would have been the moment for Joseph to kind of stand up and puff out his chest and go, well, it's about time.
And yes, I'm an expert.
Do you have any idea?
I have the gift of interpretation.
I have the gift of interpretation, as your cupbearer can attest. The other one would, but he's dead, just like I said. Instead, he says, it's not me, it's God. 2 years in the dungeon after interpreting the dream. And we're not told how long he's in the prison before interpreting the dream, but long enough to gain favor and become in charge, everything else. So he's been in prison for several years is an easy guess. And nevertheless, his first day in freedom, standing in front of Pharaoh, he is still attesting it's all God. It's all God.
Hey, Jim.
Yes, sir.
Another note here that I think might be interesting is that dreams were valued in the ancient Near East as a means of discerning the future, and professional dream interpreters were often employed by the royal courts. And so Joseph, on both of these occasions, corrects their pagan ideas about where the true interpretation of dreams come from by saying it comes from God.
Yeah, and this is very much what we see here when it says that he called together all his wise men. Those would have been the professional dream interpreters. Mm-hmm. And Pharaoh told them the dreams, and no one could interpret it for Pharaoh. And it's the same thing we see in the book of Daniel. Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. Nebuchadnezzar goes even further and tells all his wise men and his soothsayers, and everybody gathers them all in, all the Chaldeans and the magicians. And he says, you have to tell me my dream and the interpretation, and then I'll know the interpretation's right if you also tell me the dream. And they all beg him and say, no king has ever asked anything like this. They say it is a rare thing that the king requires. And he says, well, okay, then how about this? You don't tell me my dream, I cut your head off. How's that?
Wait, we'll go back.
Yeah, well, we'll take the first option. Yeah. So, yeah, the Middle East dream thing is a very big deal. So he says it's all of God. Verse 16, Joseph then answered Pharaoh and said, it is not in me. God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer. So Pharaoh spoke to Joseph, in my dream, behold, I was standing on the bank of the Nile, and behold, seven cows, fat and sleek, came up out of the Nile, and they grazed in the marsh grass. And lo, seven other cows came up after them, poor and very ugly and gaunt, such as I had never seen for ugliness in the land of Egypt. And the lean and ugly cows ate up the first seven fat cows. Yet when they had devoured them, it could not be detected that they had devoured them, for they were just as ugly as before. And then I awoke. So there are seven fat cows, big, healthy cows that come out of the Nile River, and then seven lean, gaunt, ugly cows. The lean, skinny, sickly, ugly cows eat the big, fat, healthy cows, but they're still gaunt and skinny and ugly. So eating the fat cows didn't do them any good. Verse 22, and I saw also in my dream, and behold, seven ears of corn, full and good, came up on a single stalk, and lo, seven ears withered and thin, scorched by the east wind, sprouted up after them. And the thin ears swallowed the seven good ears. Then I told it to the magicians, but there was no one who could explain it to me. So he's seen the same image twice, two different ways, which, by the way, is interesting because it's the same way that Joseph saw his dream. Joseph saw two dreams, one with the sheaves bowing down, one with the sun and the moon and the stars. Same idea, two different images. And then you get the cupbearer and the baker. You've got two dreams in the same night. You'll notice in both of them, it included Pharaoh's going to raise up your head, restore you to your job. Pharaoh's going to raise up your head and hang you. Parallelism, very typical of Hebrew thought and Hebrew literature, these parallels. So now Pharaoh has two dreams that have the same image. First, there's goodness and fatness and plenty. And then there's leanness. The leanness eats up the plenty, but it doesn't help. Verse 25. Now Joseph said to Pharaoh, Pharaoh's dreams are one and the same. God has told to Pharaoh what he is about to do. Why did God tell Pharaoh what he was about to do? I mean, God is about to impose 14 years on Pharaoh. And before he does it, he tells Pharaoh. But Pharaoh doesn't get it. Why did he do it? So Joseph could interpret it. It's all about Joseph. It's all about the Abrahamic covenant. It's all about keeping Israel alive. It's all about, he told Abraham, your descendants are going to go into a land where they're not known, and they're going to serve them for 400 years, and he has to get those people into that land. And he's going to do it through things like a dream that Pharaoh has. So God now told a heathen king prophetically what he was going to do. For Pharaoh's benefit? No! For Joseph's benefit. Can God be that particular?
He is.
He is. That's how God works. It's the only God you find in the Bible.
You know, sometimes we might hear someone who seems to have some kind of inside track with God, and we assume that they're on good terms with God because of that. But there's a sense here in which Pharaoh has an inside track with God because God's showing something to him directly, but definitely not in God's favor.
One of the great sort of quandaries of Israel's Old Testament history is that their first king, Saul. There's no indication that Saul was a saved man. And yet at one point, the Spirit of God falls on him and he prophesies. And it starts a saying around Israel, is Saul now among the sons of the prophets? So yes, did God bestow favor on Saul for that moment? Yeah. Did he save Saul? There's no indication he did. So yes, I think that's a consistent thing again that we see with God. God can use anybody. Oh, well, let's go the rest of the way. Balaam's donkey. Was that a saved donkey? Did he talk through him anyway? Yeah. The donkey saw the angel when Balaam didn't. Balaam couldn't, and the donkey could. And the donkey did the right thing even as Balaam was doing the wrong thing. So can God work through anybody?
Yeah,
absolutely. Pharaoh's dreams are one and the same. God has told to Pharaoh what he is about to do. Verse 26, the seven good cows are 7 years. And the seven good ears are 7 years. The dreams are one and the same. And the seven lean and ugly cows that came up after them are 7 years. And the seven thin ears scorched by the east wind shall be 7 years of famine. It is as I have spoken to Pharaoh. God has shown to Pharaoh what he is about to do. Behold, 7 years of great abundance are coming in all the land of Egypt. And after them, 7 years of famine will come, and all the abundance will be forgotten in the land of Egypt, and the famine will ravage the land. So the abundance will be unknown in the land because of the subsequent famine, for it will be very severe. Now, as for the repeating of the dream to Pharaoh twice, it means that the matter is determined by God, and God will quickly bring it about. Notice how he mentions the parallelism. It happened twice because God is making an emphatic statement, just like the two dreams Joseph had had. And now let Pharaoh look for a man discerning and wise and set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh take action. to appoint overseers in charge of the land and let him exact a fifth of the produce of the land of Egypt during the 7 years of abundance. Then let them gather all the food of these good years that are coming and store up the grain for food in the cities under Pharaoh's authority and let them guard it. And let the food become as a reserve for the land for the 7 years of famine, which are going to occur in the land of Egypt, so that the land may not perish during the famine. Now the proposal seemed good to Pharaoh and to all his servants. Then Pharaoh said to his servants, "Can we find a man like this, in whom is a divine spirit?" So Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Since God has informed you of all this, there is no one so discerning and wise as you are. You shall be over my house, and according to your command, all my people shall do homage. Only in the throne I will be greater than you. So you'll be second only to me. I'm going to put you in charge of absolutely everything." Think about the turnaround Joseph just went through. Several years in prison, 2 years in the dungeon, waiting for the cupbearer to just mention he's down there. And suddenly one day a jailer shows up and says, "Pharaoh wants to see you." He shaves, he gets cleaned up. Before the sun goes down on that day, he's told by Pharaoh, "You're in charge of everything." God did that. That's all God. Now, did God do that because Joseph was a great guy and God was rewarding him for his goodness? Did God do that because he wanted to make Joseph something special? No, God did all this because he's keeping a promise he made to Abraham. He's doing all this because these are his chosen elect people. He's doing all this because he's going to keep Israel alive during the famine. He's doing all this because he's got to get them into the land of Egypt. And so, why was he sold into slavery? To get to Egypt. Because God's keeping his word. Why did his brothers push him into a pit and convince Dad that he was dead? It's God's keeping his promise to Abraham. Why did he end up in Potiphar's house and have so much good favor that he ended up in charge of everything? Because God is keeping God's promises. Why was he accused of rape and then he ends up in prison? Because God is keeping his promises. Why does he languish down there for years? Because God is keeping his promises. And why in one day does he end up the second most powerful man in Egypt?
Because Joseph is a great guy.
There you go. I'm saying because he made the free will choice to be the second most powerful man in Egypt. Yeah, it's all the same answer. It's all God, it's all God, it's all God. And it's God keeping his promises to his covenant people. And he's keeping them in such diverse ways that any human just looking at the circumstances would say, "Where's God in this?" In fact, most modern evangelicalism would say, "God didn't kick in until, you know, he became second only to Pharaoh. That's when God kicked in. You know, God had nothing to do with that whole putting him in a pit thing or saying he was dead. That wasn't God. It was only God when he was put in prison, accused of rape. That wasn't God." And yet, God's through all this. Moses keeps saying, "God did it. God showed favor. God did this. God gave him the dream. God gives him the interpretation. God does all this." It's all God, regardless of the circumstances. Look, that's all I'm saying. I've been at this for a little more than an hour. I'm saying it's all God regardless of the circumstances. Don't let your humanity and your sinful flesh cause you to start judging God's faithfulness on the basis of circumstances. If you start interpreting God, if you start holding God to a standard where you say, "God, you must perform a certain way in order for me to recognize you as God in my life," then he might very well act like this. He might very well put you in prison. And so much of, again, modern evangelicalism that I've been railing against a lot lately says God wants you to be healthy, wealthy, wise, your best life now. God wants to give you good stuff all the time. That's God's plan for your life. So then what happens if something bad happens in your life? Well, if all you've ever been taught is God wants nothing but good for you, then when the bad happens, you're either going to deny God or you're going to deny your faith. You're going to wonder what happened because you've been taught so badly. But if you're taught the Bible and you understand that it's God in the good and it's God in the bad, it's God on the mountain, it's God in the valley, once you're taught that it's all God, then your faith isn't blown about by the winds and the waves and the the rocky landings, then your faith is always secure regardless of the circumstances, because God does not change even though circumstances change. And God does use means, and some of the means he uses are the bad circumstances, which kind of takes us back to Sunday morning. Both Paul and James saying that it is the hard circumstances of life that produce faith in you. It produces hope. It produces patience. It produces all of the peaceable fruit of righteousness, because you've gone through the hard circumstances and your faith wasn't shipwrecked by the circumstances. And the only way that can happen is if you're properly taught about the only God of the Bible. Yeah?
Amen.
Well, let's just finish this section. You'll be over all my house, and according to your command, all my people shall do homage. Only in the throne I will be greater than you. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, see, I have set you over all the land of Egypt. Then Pharaoh took off his signet from his hand. That's the ring. That's the king's ring. That's the one he presses into the wax to say, this is the command of the king. He takes his signet ring off and gives it to Joseph. That's all the power. That means you make any law you want, and you stamp it with that ring, and it's law now. He put it in Joseph's hand. He clothed him in garments and fine linen, and he put the gold necklace around his neck, and he had him ride in his second chariot. And they proclaimed before him, bow the knee, and he set him over all the land of Egypt. This is a Hebrew slave being driven through the streets of Egypt, and they are bowing the knee to Joseph overnight, from prison to second only to Pharaoh. Moreover, Pharaoh said to Joseph, though I am Pharaoh, yet without your permission, no one shall raise his hand or foot in all the land of Egypt. You're in complete charge. Then Pharaoh named Joseph Zephanath-Paneah, and he gave him Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, as his wife. And Joseph went forth over the land of Egypt. Now Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. And Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh and went through all the land of Egypt. And during the 7 years of plenty, the land brought forth abundantly. So he gathered all the food of these 7 years, which occurred in the land of Egypt. And he placed the food in the cities. And he placed in every city the food from its surrounding fields. Thus Joseph stored up grain in great abundance, like the sand of the sea, until he stopped measuring it, for it was beyond measure. Next week, 2 weeks from now, we're not here next week. I'll be next Wednesday in Lexington. So don't be here. In 2 weeks, mark your Bibles. 2 weeks, we start at verse 50. We're going to be introduced to the sons of Joseph. Now, we were just told that Pharaoh gave Joseph a wife, the daughter of a heathen priest. And they're going to have two kids, who are then going to be known as Ephraim and Manasseh, and they're going to become two of the 12 tribes of Israel when Levi is taken from the 12 and given no inheritance in Israel, because the Levites are going to serve in the temple and be the priests, so they don't get a land inheritance. But God's still going to divide the land 12 ways and give Ephraim and Manasseh each a piece of the land. And they're half Egyptian going out the gate. And yet God is going to bless Ephraim, the younger. We've seen this a lot, haven't we? God going for the younger one. He's going to bless the younger and give him the land inheritance. And then we're going to have to talk about what happens to the Abrahamic covenant after that. So there's a whole lot going on coming up. So next week will be, 2 weeks from now, we'll be introduced to Ephraim and Manasseh, and throughout the rest of the Old Testament, when you're talking about the northern tribes, the 10 northern tribes become known as Ephraim, the half-Egyptian son of Joseph. Got all that? So there's a lot going on here.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.